This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. An air quality alert issued for all of Massachusetts has been extended until at least midnight tonight for parts of Worcester, Middlesex, and Essex counties by the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. This after smoke from wildfires on the West Coast and Canada turned the sun red last night and made outdoor activities iffy for some sensitive groups, such as those with asthma or older adults. It may seem incredible that you can smell burning wood from thousands of miles away and see the smoke above your house, but that's what happened. So what does it mean for weather, climate, health? John Levy is a professor of environmental health at Boston University's School of Public Health. John, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me here.
All right, the first question, how does smoke from a fire that is thousands of miles away get here?
So it does seem incredible, but we see this happen actually quite frequently. The emissions from the smoke get up into the upper atmosphere, and then they can follow the jet stream and prevailing winds and travel quite some distance. You may remember last summer, we actually had episodes where dust storms in the Sahara were affecting air quality across the U.S. The wind blew halfway around the world. We've certainly seen wildfires affecting us from the West Coast. We even had wildfires in Siberia a few years ago that affected our air quality. So once it gets up in the upper atmosphere, it can travel quite a long distance. And the question is just whether it zips by us or comes down to ground level and can affect what we breathe in and affect our health.
So does that mean that it's not necessarily indicative of the intensity of the fires?
It's a combination. I mean, larger and more intense fires will certainly give you more emissions and higher concentrations. A lot of it just depends on which way the wind is blowing and what the atmospheric conditions are. One day it could head out into the ocean or head in another direction. And in recent days, obviously, the East Coast has really been kind of the target, and the winds have blown things right in our direction.
So while it seems kind of freaky, to use a colloquialism, are you suggesting that perhaps it's not generally necessarily a problem for this to happen unless certain conditions are met? Or is it always problematic when you've got smoke from fires like this coming across communities?
Well, it's certainly problematic. And when you have smoke and wildfires at this magnitude, it's going to affect somebody. So it may not affect us on one occasion, but it's going to affect somebody else. Certainly the populations living near the wildfires receive a very heavy burden from that and substantial air quality effects. But those effects, as we've seen, can spread over thousands of miles and affect different populations in different locales. So as we see these wildfires increase in intensity and in frequency, you know, there are a number of us both close to the fires and further downwind that are going to continue to be affected.
I can't even imagine what it might be like near the fires. But let's talk about how much smoke is in the air here. How do we measure that? Like, what is it that we count to know that there's a lot of smoke in the air? And what tips us into the danger zone from an air quality standpoint?
So the monitors that are followed, at least through the Department of Environmental Protection, are set out in a number of area communities. They measure multiple pollutants. Fine particulate matter, or PM2.5, is the one that really has been triggered the most by these wildfires and the one that has been, you know, leading us to be concerned about potential health effects. And so we have, again, monitors everywhere that are measuring those. And when levels get into a range of concern, that's what gets these report outs to restrict outdoor activities and engage in other protective measures.
And so what would a normal number be, and what's the number we're looking at right now?
It certainly depends where you are. Obviously, communities have other sources of particulate matter air pollution, but in general, in Massachusetts, we're often in the single digits of micrograms per cubic meter. So we're maybe at, you know, 7, 8, 9 on a typical day. You know, numbers were getting appreciably higher than that in recent days. You know, I don't know the numbers offhand, but certainly well higher than that and at a level that would trigger concern.
So I feel like one of the obvious next questions, John, is how much of this is due to climate change, both the fires and the ability of these byproducts reaching all the way here and compounding you know, air that you say already has potentially other particulate matter in it. And I do want to note right now in Boston, that number is 81.
Okay. Yeah. So there's, yeah, clearly at a level of concern. And this does connect with climate change in a few different ways. So as I mentioned, probably the most obvious one is with climate change, you get more frequent and more intense wildfires. And so that is going to trigger these kinds of episodes. You know, certainly we've seen record heat in the Pacific Northwest in recent weeks and months, you know, severe drought in the West, and those all create the conditions for more wildfires. So as the climate changes, we're going to see this happening more often. You know, the other things that can happen in a warming climate is you get the conditions that create more air pollution. So for example, at higher temperatures, you get more ozone formation that tends to form on hot and humid days. Some of the other precursors of fine particulate matter, these are sort of things that form PM2.5 in the atmosphere, also are emitted more at higher temperatures. So we raise the temperatures here in Massachusetts, we create conditions for more of these air pollutants to form. You know, there's also just these complicated feedback loops where some researchers at BU showed that forest fires themselves actually contribute to more climate change by reducing our ability to store carbon. So climate change gives you the forest fires actually then give you more climate change.
You know, I'm aware that, you know, we already know, for example, asthma rates tend to be higher in areas that meet the criteria for being environmental justice zones. You're talking about a cycle here that can compound those factors. How do people protect themselves today? Who's at risk? And especially for those still under this advisory till midnight tonight, you know, people in parts of Worcester, Middlesex, Essex counties, what precautions should people most at risk take?
Yeah, so those who are most at risk are typically, you know, people who might be susceptible to respiratory or cardiovascular effects. So kids with asthma are of concern, people with cardiovascular disease who've had a previous heart attack. You know, there's groups of people that the EPA designate as of concern for air pollution. Certainly avoiding outdoor exercise if you're in one of those groups makes good sense. But something else you could do that's quite important are actually a lot of the measures we've been taking to address COVID can help you with this kind of wildfire air pollution. So wearing a mask outdoors can actually help reduce your exposure. You know, cloth face masks don't do quite as much as an N95, but they do something, and an N95 does quite a bit more. And using something like a portable HEPA filter in your home, which again some people have done or schools and other businesses have done to reduce COVID risk, that actually can bring down the level of particulate air pollution quite a bit. So you can take a lot of actions kind of in your home and on your person, and it's actually good for COVID exposure risk and good for air pollution risk as well.
Over the next few weeks, do you expect us to see more of this, John?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think this is going to come and go as the weather shifts. It might be good for one day, and then it might pick up again, you know, on another day. And so I think we're going to see this, you know, certainly in the days and weeks to come, and certainly in other, you know, other summers to come. So this is unfortunately going to be probably a prevailing concern that we're going to have to keep our eye on.
Okay, that is John Levy, a professor of environmental health at Boston University's School of Public Health. We had a lot of questions there, John. Thank you for joining us to help answer them.
Thanks for having me here. Take care.
Throughout the summer, we are inviting the major candidates who are officially running for governor to make their case to you. Earlier this month, we spoke to Republican candidate and former state representative Jeff Diehl and Democratic candidate and state senator Sonia Chang Diaz. You can find those conversations on our website, radioboston.org. Today, we welcome former state senator Ben Downing, who is running to be the Democratic candidate for governor. Senator Downing, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
So I'm going to start with a question that I have asked every candidate who's joined us. That is, what makes you now in 2021 better than anyone else to be governor now and to run the Commonwealth?
So first, I bring a statewide perspective and coalition to the race. I grew up in Pittsfield, represented that community and 51 other communities in Western Massachusetts. I know the unique challenges and opportunities that our gateway cities and the rural regions of this state face. But I've also raised a family for the last 4 years here in East Boston and know the challenges that this immigrant community deals with every single day around housing, around transportation, and any number of other issues. And I think to be an effective governor, you need to be able to see both those perspectives, bring them together, and be able to tap into the potential that exists in all 351 cities and towns in this Massachusetts.
So key to many parts of your platform, like funding childcare, reducing income inequality, is taxing higher earners. The millionaire's tax appears to be going before voters in 2022. Do you think a millionaire's tax is the best way to fight income inequality, and why?
Yes, it is. We can ask those who have benefited from economic growth over the last 5 years, the last 10 years, the last 20 years. We can ask them to pay more to make the investments we need to make in universal childcare, in transportation, in housing, in education, to have debt-free higher education. It's the least we can ask of those who have benefited even during the COVID pandemic recession. So yes, I support the millionaire's tax. I've voted for it in the past. And above and beyond that, I'll also be rolling out my own comprehensive tax plan if that were to not move forward, because these are investments we need to make to address economic fairness, racial justice.
How do you successfully make that case to the millionaires, or do you just work around them and get it passed without them?
I think you need to be willing to listen to everyone, but I think it's fairly obvious that when we are talking about rampant economic inequality in every corner of Massachusetts, what you see is that the state government has failed to make the investments that we need to make in our communities to be able to address that. And that has come at a time where we have cut taxes in a way that has disproportionately benefited the wealthiest for the better part of the last three decades. This is about getting back to what we used to do to build a fairer, stronger Massachusetts. There's simple steps that we can take. We can listen to everyone. But when all is said and done, we need to fight for people who have been my neighbors, who I represented in the Senate, folks in communities that for too long have been an afterthought, for too long have been forgotten, those who suffer when we kick the can down the road at the state.
So you made an allusion a minute ago to other tax policies that could be put in place if this doesn't pass. But just there, you made a pretty strong case that this is the equitable way to do it. So who and what are you going to tax to fund these programs if the millionaire's tax doesn't pass?
I think you need to put everything on the table when it comes to existing economic development incentives, loopholes in our existing structure. You need to be able to look at every single tax in a comprehensive way and say, who is paying for it and how do we make sure that we fund the public services that we need? For too long in Massachusetts, we've fought about this tax hike or that tax cut, and we haven't had the broader discussion about what are the public goods that we need to fund. And that is how you end up in a broader community here in Massachusetts with massive economic inequality, with regional inequity that leaves behind the communities that I've called home in Western and Central Massachusetts, that leaves behind my neighbors here in East Boston.
All right, I want to talk about progressive voice in this race. Senator Downing, you're running against at least two other Democratic candidates that would call themselves progressives. Do you call yourself a progressive, and what sets you apart from the other candidates?
Yeah, so first, I got into this race long before there were any other candidates in it. We announced in February because I thought the need for a more urgent sense of leadership was critical in this. So yes, I believe I am a progressive. I have a voting record that is a progressive record from my time in office, and have partnered with progressive allies in the state house and outside of the state house to try to bring about the change we need in our communities. And I think the unique aspect that I bring to that is that I have been a climate leader, and a climate leader who is focused on equity from day one. I have worked and led on climate issues throughout my entire public career. I'm also a leader who folks can trust. I made a promise that I would term limit myself my first election in 2006 and kept to that. And when I left, I didn't take some lobbying job. I didn't take some government relations job. I joined a clean energy leader, and I said I want to be a part of the transition to a just, a fair, and a sustainable tomorrow for everyone. So I think I'm uniquely positioned as a progressive in this race to help us make the urgent transition we need to away from fossil fuels to a clean energy economy that benefits everyone.
So you went to the private sector. You stuck with your promise to term and limit yourself, but that also took you out of the public eye. In 2016, you were in the private sector. Now you've got opponents on the Democratic side. State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz is a current elected official, a prominent voice in legislative battles on things like education and police reform. You've got Danielle Allen, a highly visible Harvard professor and author. Name recognition is an issue, and it's going to be hard to win this race without it. How are you going to grow your name recognition back in the public eye?
So a couple of things. First, I think the perspective that I got being away from Beacon Hill, stepping outside of the bubble that too often defines debate at the statehouse, is a valuable thing. It has allowed me to realize just how small our ambitions are too often at the statehouse. And the work I did outside of Massachusetts showed me what other states were doing with far less by way of resources. So first, I think I bring a unique perspective in that regard. Along with that, you know, I'm going to be able to achieve the name recognition we need the only way that you can, the only way that I know how, which is campaigning day and night across the 351 cities and towns of Massachusetts. We've already done 70 plus Democratic town committees and caucuses. We're out there meeting with folks every single day in communities that too often have been an afterthought, too often have been left behind. And I think we have a resilient coalition in Western Massachusetts, in our gateway cities, and in among climate voters. That's our path to victory, both in the primary and the general election. And it's one that I'm excited about knitting together.
So that's a really retail politics strategy on the ground, door to door. You have talked with pride about being sort of an outsider who won the first time you ran, youngest state senator in the Commonwealth. You know, out there in the fall, there is the question of whether Attorney General Maura Healey will join the Democratic primary. And that, I mean, if she does, that just changes the race. Does the door to door approach hold in that case, or will you have to take a different strategy?
Our approach and our strategy is our strategy, regardless of who's in the field, regardless of if the attorney general, my friend, gets into the race or not, regardless of if Governor Baker runs again. That's why I got in February. That was our strategy from the beginning. And I think that's a type of politics that, especially after the last year plus, people are hungry for. We want to be able to come together to take on big things. We've been told for too long by our leaders that we are incapable of addressing the challenges that we see every day in our communities. And I know from my experience outside of the statehouse that if we are able to tap into the potential, able to tap in to the energy, the talents in our communities, then the future of Massachusetts is limitless. What we're missing is that urgent form of leadership. So we're going to run an urgent campaign that models the type of leadership we want to bring to the statehouse.
You just talked about the big things, right? The big systemic things and how important they are after the last year. And I do get that. It's been one heck of a 16 or 17 months. But I am also mindful that Governor Baker has had, and we don't know if he's running, but that part isn't necessary to the question I'm going to ask you now. He has had near stratospheric popularity at times as a governor who's known as a day-to-day manager. And I also think of the late Boston Mayor Tom Menino, elected to 5 terms, known as an urban mechanic. And I wonder how you bridge the big issues, the systemic structural stuff, with what may be a voter base that looks like it likes day-to-day management, more potholes and playgrounds than wealth inequality.
Yeah, so I think you find a way to bridge the two, right? And when we talk about climate action, we're talking about actually rebuilding our transportation system. So instead of being an embarrassment and something that holds us back, it's the envy of the world. We need to have a strong, robust, reliable transit system if we're actually going to be able to combat climate change. And hey, by the way, doing that is also an issue of racial and economic justice and regional equity. So we find a way to connect those broader issues with the experiences that folks see in their day-to-day lives. And I think it's critically important that as Democrats, especially if Governor Baker runs, we don't just say, well, Charlie Baker's a Republican, you don't like national Republicans, don't vote for them. But rather, we point out what we would do if we earn voters' trust and have the responsibility and the honor of putting together a government, of running an administration. And also we point out the shortcomings of this administration. I think too often Governor Baker has benefited from the bar being set too low, right? We're going to make sure to point out the shortcomings of Governor Baker's record and point out what we would do if we're lucky enough to earn voters' trust over the course of this campaign.
So you've brought him into the mix now in this conversation. You told WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks that you believe the governor is, quote, a good man and a dedicated public servant, end quote. What has his administration done wrong, and what kind of grade would you give him for the coronavirus pandemic?
So Governor Baker, when it comes to sort of generally what Governor Baker has done around, I don't think he's had the sense of urgency to be able to address the big challenge in front of us. Too often, the governor has had to be pulled along on climate. When I wrote the law that created the offshore wind industry, that wasn't a priority for the Baker administration. They had to be pulled along ultimately to sign up for that. On the Roe Act, when we know that the fundamental rights of women across Massachusetts are being challenged by conservative justices at the federal level, the governor had to be pulled along to sign on to that. On any number of key pieces of legislation, the governor is not out front leading, but rather we have to expend energy to pull him along. When it comes to the COVID-19 vaccine response, I think on communication, too often the communication to local communities and local providers has been one way, and they have not feel like their concerns and their expertise has been heard. When it comes to the vaccine rollout, I think Governor Baker scrapped the 20-year playbook that the Department of Public Health and local boards of health had established. We should have had centralized pre-registration from the beginning that would have allowed for greater partnerships and a greater focus on equity from the beginning that would have allowed us to get some of the hesitancy we're dealing with right now.
So if you were governor tomorrow, what is the first change you would make in the state's COVID strategy or COVID policy?
The first change that I would make in the state's COVID strategy and the state's COVID policy would be to actually have an open line of communication, especially with the K-12 system. You know, we're now about 4 weeks out at most from schools reopening, and I know there is a great deal of confusion. The governor and his administration have not been out front and communicating with, in particular, the K-12 public school systems around what the expectations are going to be, around the data for from which they are measuring on that. I think that is the most important unknown at this point, along with deeper partnerships with local community coalitions, community-based organizations, not just to run vaccine-focused events, but rather to partner in existing community events that people are hungry to get to and to figure out how we can wrap in the vaccine rollout to those efforts.
So last question for you. You've talked about being a progressive. This is a state that tends to like a split governance, right? Republicans in the governor's mansion and a Democratic state and state house. How do you pick up voters in the general election running as a progressive?
I think the most important thing is that we remember we have to earn voters' trust. I think voters rightly look at the state house and they say, there's a lot of Democrats up there. If I put a Democrat in the corner office, what's going to happen? We are being specific, and I am being specific about the type of campaign that we're running. We're not taking donations from lobbyists, from PACs, or from fossil fuel interests to show voters that they can be confident in trusting me and in trusting the administration that we will build. Just like they can be confident because of the fact that I made a promise I would term limit myself and held to that over time. We're going to continue to run a campaign that voters, Democrats, independents, and even some Republicans are going to look at and say, we might not agree with everything that Ben Downing says, but I know as governor, I'll be able to trust him and that he will act with the best interest of the public in mind. So we will put trust first and foremost. That's how Democrats win. We've got to give our base something to come out for, and we've got to be able to earn their trust.
Former State Senator Ben Downing, who's running to be the Democratic candidate for governor, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
In areas with substantial and high transmission, CDC recommends fully vaccinated people wear masks in public indoor settings to help prevent the spread of the Delta variant and protect others. This includes schools. CDC recommends that everyone in K-12 schools wear a mask indoors, regardless of vaccination status.
That is new. That's Dr. Rochelle Walensky speaking this hour at a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention telebriefing. The CDC is now reversing course and recommending that fully vaccinated people wear masks in certain parts of the country and in schools indoors. Vaccination rates are below 50% in some communities, even as the Delta variant continues to spread and overall cases spike. Boston wastewater data suggests cases have increased almost 8%. fold since mid-June, and questions arising now about how to handle schools in the fall with children under 12 still ineligible for vaccines, even, you know, the new CDC guidance in place. Those questions exist. Lots of COVID news. A time now for Ask the Doctors. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your coronavirus questions. I know we have them. So here to help us, Dr. Cassandra Pierre, acting hospital epidemiologist and an infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center, and Dr. Helen Boucher, infectious disease physician at Tufts Medical Center and an interim dean of the Tufts University School of Medicine. Dr. Pierre, welcome back.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
And Dr. Boucher, thanks for coming back as well.
Thank you for having me.
So, Dr. Pierre, big news there just in the last little bit from the CDC as they shift their guidance on indoor mask wearing. I want to ask you your reaction to that and how important you think it is, and under what circumstances people should continue to wear masks indoors, vaccinated or unvaccinated.
I think this recommendation does make a lot of sense. I think it can feel like it's giving people whiplash. You know, we've had this brief, wonderful reprieve for those of us who are fully vaccinated in terms of foregoing masks, or at least the option to forego a mask. But as we've seen in the past few weeks, our case numbers are climbing. The Delta variant is more highly transmissible. And as a consequence, potentially as like collateral damage, we're seeing some more breakthrough infections among those who are fully vaccinated. So to be clear, these breakthroughs are more mild infections, but there is some concern about secondary transmission from fully vaccinated individuals as well. And so given the concern about children going into schools and limiting the amount of transmission even from potentially fully vaccinated individuals, it does make sense that with these numbers that we're reversing trajectory a bit, even though it does feel like a little bit of whiplash for some.
So, Dr. Boucher, part of this is the CDC recommending that even fully vaccinated people wear masks in areas where there's substantial or high transmission rates. According to the AP, that includes Bristol and Barnstable counties here in Massachusetts. Your reaction to that, and what does it mean for there to be a substantial or high transmission rate? If you could answer both of those.
Yeah, let me give it a try. So, first and foremost, just want to emphasize that vaccination is still the most powerful tool we have here. And so we don't want to lose sight of that as we talk about other mitigation measures. The fact, as was just mentioned, is that we have seen an uptick in some regions of our state, and that according to the our interpretation of what substantial risk means, those two counties may be meeting those criteria now. It will be up to Governor Baker in the Department of Public Health to make the formal recommendations about our actions here in Massachusetts. Remember, the CDC guides, the state makes the policy. But what it tells us is that there is likely substantial spread in our region, and that we need to pay attention. I think, again, to come back to it, the most important thing is to get those people who are not vaccinated vaccinated as soon as we can.
And what is substantial, Dr. Pierre? Is there as I understand it, it's sort of a number of cases per 100,000. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, I think we've looked at different numbers at different time points. So I would say that, you know, it's definitely high case numbers per 100,000, but it's also potentially the rate of acceleration of increased cases that we're seeing in a region as well. And so probably it will be, you know, up to jurisdictions. We're still thinking about what that firm number would be. But I would say that the high numbers that we've been talking about in Bristol, Barnstable County, potentially, depending on what the governor thinks of, may qualify as fitting that description.
So the two of you are really, it sounds like, now turning to the governor to see what step he's going to take next in terms of public health recommendations here in the Commonwealth. Is that fair, Dr. Boucher?
Yeah, that's the way, you know, that's the way the system works, is that the CDC provides guidance and then that the states and provide the actual policy that we need to follow. I think for your listeners and for all of us as citizens, you know, it's important that we pay attention to this information. And there's been emerging information about the Delta variant that is concerning. And again, I'm going to be like your broken record today. It keeps just reinforcing the fact that vaccines are the best tool we have to protect ourselves and our families. And, you know, they're the reason why this isn't a lot worse right now.
And Dr. Pierre, you know, cases 8 times higher than lows in June. I know that still the overall numbers are low compared to the peaks earlier this year and last winter. You know, our positivity rate is above 1.6%, though, 4 times higher than at the beginning of July. What would you, if you were advising the governor, what would you tell him to do right now?
Well, I think that the Delta variant is clearly a force to be reckoned with. So in addition to thinking about how we can continue to support vaccination efforts in our entire Commonwealth, but especially in those particularly under-vaccinated spots that remain vulnerable, especially as we move into cooler weather, having more indoor teaching and congregation, I would recommend really taking a critical look at the activities that we have seen in our Commonwealth and elsewhere contributing to spread of COVID-19. And although it's really difficult to feel like we're backtracking on the progress that we've made and we're really weary of COVID-19, it's not done with us. And so we really do need to take a hard look and make sure that we are protecting our communities, ourselves, our families, and particularly the most vulnerable, including those who are unvaccinated, but children and those who are not eligible for vaccination yet as well. But I second my colleague in saying that vaccination really is one of the most important methods that we have at this point. We still need to think, as we're getting those vaccination rates up and higher, hopefully, what other layers of infection prevention we've used in the past still work and can work for us moving forward.
1-800-423-8255 to ask your coronavirus question, your vaccine question, your booster shot question, your Delta variant question of Drs. Pierre and Boucher. We have Kathy on the line in Stoneham. Kathy, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm very concerned about my husband. He had Guillain-Barré about 30 years ago, and he's very reluctant to take the vaccine, but I'm very concerned about him, you know, with the new variant. So I wondered what the doctors would advise.
Okay, Dr. Boucher.
Yeah, so, you know, that is a, you know, a very real concern. And I certainly recommend that your husband speak with his doctor. The information that we have is that in general, the vaccine may still be acceptable for your husband, particularly an mRNA vaccine, which is much less associated with Guillain-Barré than, say, the adenovirus or the J&J vaccine. But certainly that's an important question for him to speak with his physician about. This does, you know, emphasize a point about those vulnerable people, as Dr. Pierre just said, those who can't get vaccinated. We want to surround them with vaccinated people to provide as much protection. And certainly the unvaccinated need to really be wearing a mask indoors at this time.
And again, that number to ask your coronavirus question is 1-800-423-8255. I want to play now a little more sound from Dr. Walensky earlier this hour. Here she is.
Information on the Delta variant from several states and other countries indicates that in rare occasions, some vaccinated people infected with the Delta variant after vaccination may be contagious and spread the virus to others. This new science is worrisome and unfortunately warrants an update to our recommendations.
So a million questions, Dr. Pierre, just coming out of that. And I will start with, it's almost like it's easy to lose track of what we thought we knew, what we did know, what we didn't know. How surprising is it to find that some vaccinated people infected with the Delta variant after vaccination, and I'm using her words here, may be contagious and spread the virus to others?
It is, you know, for someone like myself who's been in healthcare over the past few weeks, unsurprising to hear that. And I just want to reiterate, you know, the vaccines have been still incredibly effective against the Delta variant, and we still see much lower secondary transmission from individuals who are fully vaccinated than from those who are unvaccinated. The issue, the wrench that has been thrown into our system, unfortunately, is this highly transmissible variant. And it has you know, a lot of properties that we're learning more and more about. And one of them is obviously its high transmissibility and also the potential to emit a lot more viral particles than with the previous variants that we saw. And so the properties do lend to the potential of just being exposed to over, you know, a thousandfold more viral particles. And so for individuals, even those who are more fully vaccinated, their viral loads, when they are infected or have a breakthrough infection, may be higher, even though the vast majority are going to be asymptomatic or have mild infection. But having that higher viral load serves as a risk for others, specifically especially those who are unvaccinated. So I would say that this is, we've been seeing potential evidence for this, but it does seem like a bit of a change from what we were hearing in the past few months. And in the past few months, it was true. We weren't seeing as much secondary transmission, but with a more highly transmissible variant, which is really the consequence of not having an effective vaccination strategy or having enough vaccination in the country, in the region, and globally, we have the opportunity for more breakthrough infections and more secondary transmissions.
Okay, and just briefly, Dr. Boucher, and then I'll go back to the phones to follow up. This the advice for people who are vaccinated to mask, if I'm hearing correctly, remains largely protect others, less so to protect one who is already vaccinated. Because I'm aware that the messaging, some are concerned that the messaging otherwise is, well, why bother getting the vaccination if I'm still going to have to mask up and I can still get the Delta virus? We're really talking about protecting other people, correct?
I think that's fair, but you know, I also think in the setting of spread and concern about, you know, outbreaks, which we haven't seen thankfully in Massachusetts, but they're seeing in other parts of the country, you know, even with 90 to 95% efficacy, and we know that these vaccines are that effective in real life, some vaccinated individuals will become infected, and we just don't want anyone to become infected. And so that's the other reason to consider masking at this time. And I think it's important to point out that the CDC is responding to real-time data as it emerges. And, you know, I think we should be really grateful to them for doing the job that they do and making these recommendations. And we have to expect that things will continue to change and be dynamic.
One of my colleagues is noting to me also, since Dr. Walensky was talking while I was on air, and while you were preparing to join us, that she also mentioned concern about the next mutations that come after Delta, and that's another reason for wanting people where there's higher rates of transmission, even if they're vaccinated, to mask indoors. Now, I want to go back to the phones, 1-800-423-8255. We've got Eleni on the line in Chinatown. Eleni, go ahead.
Hi. Two weeks ago, I visited my daughter in Whiteville, North Carolina. She has three children, 8 to 2, and she works at a school after school program that one of the children got COVID, and then apparently four more got it. So there was this rumor going around that it's actually just a stomach virus. So the school itself did not bother testing my daughter. She got all the signs, vomiting, headache, chills, fatigue, and she was like that for over a week. Her husband got that. He actually got the diarrhea and the headaches and the chills. And then my other daughter also got it with a splitting headache. Both of my daughters got terrible headaches. I got the Moderna vaccine. My two daughters got the Pfizer. Her husband did not get vaccinated. And I'm concerned about the three children. And I'm also concerned that my other daughter went to South Carolina, Myrtle Beach. She went to urgent care, and they didn't bother testing for COVID at all.
Okay, thanks for that. So what I'm going to take with that, Dr. Pierre, is this moment when we see people who are vaccinated, they show symptoms that can be COVID and maybe not be COVID. And the question is, do they get tested? How do they get tested? How important is testing? What do you do if you're around someone who's showing symptoms that might or might not be COVID and they haven't been tested? We are running across people who are running across this.
Yeah, I am grateful to Eleni for this question. It is something that I am discussing with friends and family. The breakthrough cases that we're seeing can mimic viral infections, viral upper respiratory tract infections, even sometimes gastroenteritis, the symptoms she was describing. And so we can't be complacent. Again, the variant is not trivial. You know, potentially for those who are fully vaccinated, it is a viral infection and then it passes. But again, for those who might be exposed to you, it could be something much more. And so, again, it feels like going back to the beginning and talking about the basics. Even though the vaccines are incredibly important to protect others, we need to mask and we need to continue to test when we develop symptoms. So many of us who are fully vaccinated are downplaying the symptoms, understandably so, thinking that they may be allergies, that they may just be a virus. And we are, in fact, seeing the resurgence of many viruses that we didn't during the pandemic as we were all masked uniformly. But in this case, unfortunately, breakthrough infections can absolutely present as mild viral infections and therefore cannot be ignored and should not be ignored. So please, if you are having symptoms, do not ignore them. Find your nearest testing facility and get tested.
1-800-423-8255. We have another question on breakthroughs. Jane in Belmont. Jane, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So with the variants for vaccinated people, I feel like we're relying on old data that it's, you know, 93% effective in preventing an infection. But in reading in the media, you're hearing about breakthrough infections right and left. And I feel like we haven't caught, our numbers haven't caught up with what's happening real time. And I'd like to know, what do we know about that? When will we have accurate numbers? And is it more like it's 50% effective at this point? Thanks. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for the question, Jane. Dr. Boucher, I'll turn that to you.
Yeah, so I can try to help on a couple of fronts. So a couple of data points to think about. If we look at where we are today compared to a year ago, the chances of dying are 70% lower. That's real life vaccine efficacy. We could also look at LA County, where they've had, you know, trouble again with the Delta variant. They just released 6 month data that ended just a few weeks ago. That's a county of over 10 million people, the biggest county in our country. And the percentage of people with breakthrough infection who got sick enough to go in the hospital and who died was tiny, tiny, 0.0006%, I believe. So real life evidence that the vaccines are as effective with the Delta variant as they were in the clinical trials. So as of yet, we don't have any data that would support that the vaccines are not as effective in the with the Delta as they were with the earlier, the Alpha virus.
So what about some of the types of studies we're hearing? And boy, I want to be careful in asking this question, Dr. Boucher, because I don't want to spread misinformation. We have heard in news reports studies of different qualities, and some are peer-reviewed or maybe not, that are beginning to raise questions. Where are those questions coming from if we really don't have any data as yet to suggest that the vaccines are less effective against the Delta variant?
Yeah, you know, I think that it's very important that we review every study carefully, and there certainly have been studies of individual cases of breakthrough infection that are, you know, really worrisome. And I think it's important for us to understand those and to continue to investigate. But the data that we have that's sort of population-based, looking at big groups of people, so far bears out that the vaccines are as effective against the variant as they have been against the wild type or the Alpha earlier strain of the virus. And you know, it does take time, as the caller points out, for us to have kind of real-time data on what we're seeing here today. But it's quite reassuring when we look at things like mortality data, you know, that doesn't lie. And that's very, very, that should be very, very reassuring and hopefully motivating for those on the fence to really think about going and getting that vaccine now.
Let's pick up Teresa in West Roxbury. Teresa, go ahead.
Oh, hi there. I have had both the Pfizer vaccines since April and was recently in Provincetown during that last outbreak. So I returned back to Boston and called to get tested just to be on the safe side. And I was basically told by my healthcare people that I would only be tested if I was either known contact with somebody that had the virus or if I was symptomatic.
And your question is that correct, or how do you get tested anyway?
Well, I guess my question is, how do we actually do realistic contact tracing when we know asymptomatic people can spread it? And I couldn't honestly say if I was in contact with anybody at that time.
That's a good question, Dr. Pierre.
Teresa, that's an excellent point. I think that, you know, for many of us, the news is just swirling, changing so frequently. I think that for those who were in P-Town and in fact, really any recent hotspot and where they were in indoor settings, particularly without their masks on, whether they were fully vaccinated or not, in May and June, the recommendation would have been really to wait until, you know, becoming symptomatic or potentially if you had a known contact. But like in, you know, closer to the height of the epidemic, we did know that people were in contact with those whose symptoms they didn't know, who were having asymptomatic infections. And again, the Delta variant is highly transmissible. And so I say that, you know, I concur with the town managers of Provincetown who have recommended that individuals who are in P-Town, then at least, get tested. And for those who might be in situations where they're concerned about exposure, who have been without a mask in settings that are indoors, without a mask, and with those who have unknown vaccination statuses, that if there's a concern, that they should get tested. It's about community care and care for those, again, in our orbit who are unvaccinated or are vulnerable. And so, you know, I can't say which testing centers are going to which indications for testing, but I do think it is really important that people who are concerned about their status be able to get tested. This is one of the layers of protection that we have to mitigate spread.
So, Dr. Boucher, we're short on time, so I won't go back to the phones, but I will say that Rashid in Weymouth wanted to know if there are long-term symptoms with Delta, and I'm assuming that's also a question about long COVID. Just briefly, what do we know?
Right. I don't know anything beyond what you said, Tiziana, right? We're learning so much about long-haul COVID and separating out the earlier cases from now the cases associated with Delta. I'm not aware of any data doing that, but boy, no one wants to get COVID or long COVID, so really think about getting your vaccine.
So, Dr. Boucher, I'm going to stick with you. You were nice and tight on that, so I can give you one more sentence. And I hear you hammering away at people getting vaccinated. On a scale of 1 to 10, you know, is it a 10 in terms of the strategy to get us past this at this point?
It's a 100. It is the tool we have that is the most effective and efficient.
All right. That is Dr. Helen Boucher with some real clarity for us there. Infectious disease physician at Tufts Medical Center, interim dean at the Tufts University School of Medicine, and Dr. Cassandra Pierre, acting hospital epidemiologist and infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center. Drs. Boucher, Pierre, thank you. This was generous of your time. We appreciate you joining us for Ask the Doctors. That's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Withman, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. We had help from Stephen Gelman. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.